Thank you for listening today. I'd like to begin firstly by acknowledging traditional owners of the land where Let's Talk is broadcast. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders and non-Indigenous elders. This is Let's Talk, coming to you from the studios of 98.9 FM in Brisbane. We're syndicated across the National Indigenous Radio Service and streamed live on the web at 98.9fm.com.au. Well, today I'm with Bruce Pascoe, a prolific writer of fiction, young adult fiction and non-fiction. Last year, his book, Fogadocs, won the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Young Adult Fiction. In his latest non-fiction offering, Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident, Bruce attempts to rebut the entrenched view that pre-colonial Aboriginal people were hunter-gatherers and didn't farm the land. Good morning to you, Bruce Pascoe.
Good morning, Karen.
And welcome to Let's Talk.
I'm really pleased to be able to talk to all the mob up there.
Tell us firstly a bit about yourself. Who are your mob and where's your country?
Well, our people are from Tasmania, but we have a Boonwurrung connection and also a Yuin connection.
And you're currently living on Yuin land?
That's right.
Tell us how you actually, you know, came to be living in that circumstance. I guess probably the shorthand version, Bruce.
Well, I taught here as a school teacher at the Little Mallacoota School in the 70s. I then farmed a small property and went promptly broke. Then went over to the Otways with my wife, and when our youngest child went to university, we said, oh, let's go back. So that's how we came back to Mallacoota, and we're actually living upstream at Gypsy Point, which is a very beautiful place.
I said you're a prolific writer. How many books have you actually published?
27, Karen. And it feels like it. But
what was your first title?
The first one was a book of about the birds of Mallacoota, actually, which I wrote with the school kids here. The next one was a book which told a little bit of Aboriginal history about this area. But the first commercial release was a book called Night Animals, which was published by Penguin.
And have you always had a desire to write?
Look, I've always wanted. I've been a great reader. You know, my grandmother's bribed me with books to keep going at school because I hated school. But they knew I liked reading, so they just kept bribing me. Do one more year, and you get this book. Do another year, and you get that book. So I'm really indebted to my grandparents and my parents, obviously. But they, you know, my grandmother said to me, when I was about 11 or 12, she said, our people have always been poor and we're sick of it. You know, the only way to get ahead is to get an education. And so she pushed and shoved until we all did that. We went from having no one who'd finished high school in our family to all of my cousins and myself finishing university. And it was all due to her.
And where was this, in Tasmania, or had the family moved to Victoria by that
time? We were in Victoria then. Our family has got a peculiar history in that we were going backwards and forwards between Tasmania and Victoria for 100 years before our part of the family settled in Victoria. But we've got relations everywhere. We've got, you know, people up on the Cape, in Wiradjuri country, down here in Yuin country, everywhere.
And so writing, what happened there?
I just love telling stories because I was always in awe of my father's ability to tell a good yarn. My aunts, you know, you only had to make a pot of tea and they just roll out story after story after story. And some of them were favourites and they'd tell them again and again. But because of the way they told them, they were never boring. So I thought that's the way to go. And that's why I love books, because I could then get into other people's heads with the stories they told. But I was writing very bad love poetry when I was 15, and but by the time I was about 22, 23, I started writing short stories, and Then when my uncle got on my back about following the family history, you know, I was overwhelmed by my ignorance of Australian history, because the elders were telling me what had really happened to the family and what had happened to their families, and how we were really at the, you know, the epicentre of Australian history in a way, being Aboriginal people, and that if you didn't know your history, then how could you stand up for your people? And so I, with their help, I re-educated myself, or they re-educated me, and I, many of those people are dead now, and so I'm responsible for my own education, and it just went along from there, and I realised then that my job as an Aboriginal person was to tell the story the right way.
And was that, I mean, you know, in telling the real Aboriginal history of this country, was that convincing ground in the case of your family, or does it go further than that?
It goes a bit further than that. I was telling the history through the novels and the stories initially. You know, people would tell me a story, and I would, you know, with their help and endorsement, I would refashion it to make it a short story or a poem or whatever. Even as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, my son showed me some Aboriginal sites in the Blue Mountains where he was working at the time. And, you know, for me to have my son show me such important places was very, very moving. But also I realised he had selected the things to show me. And on the cover of the new book, Dark Emu, is a photograph of one of the sites he showed me, where the dark emu leaves the earth and goes up into the sky, but also a little cave where there were three lonely hand stencils in a cave. And I was very moved by that, and told a story called Lament for Three Hands, because it seemed to me that this was a last refuge for people in the Darug people in the Blue Mountains escaping the violence. So, you know, that's how the stories arrive. And I've been told so many fascinating stories. Some of them I'll never be able to tell because they're too close to the sacred bone, you might say. But others of them I'm allowed to tell. And but I've got more than I'll ever be able to write.
As I mentioned before, last year your young adult book, Fogadox, won the Prime Minister's Literary Award. Where were you in terms of Dark Emu? Was that still being written at that stage, or have you already?
It was at the publisher. Yeah. We were working on the edits of that book. I'd finished Dark Emu before Bill Gammage had finished his book, but there were some hiccups with a couple of publishers, some of whom actually didn't believe that Aboriginal people were engaged in agriculture. Eventually, Mugabala, the wonderful people in WA at Broome, they took it on, and I'll be forever grateful to them for that.
Are you able to name those other publishers who wouldn't go there? I mean, clearly there must have been interest in the initial stages.
No, I don't think I'll name them, Karen, because I don't want, you know, I'm not here to sort of stab people in the back or anything like that. It was disappointing. One of them was, you know, one of Australia's biggest publishers. The other one was a publisher who, you know, had a responsibility for Aboriginal culture. But it's, you know, that's water under the bridge. They believed in what they were doing at the time. I just think it's, you know, part of the Australian experience that people really find it hard to believe that Aboriginal people were not hunters and gatherers. One of the great joys of writing Convincing Ground was I got so much mail from Aboriginal people. A third of the letters and emails and phone calls I got were from Aboriginal people. And that was exhilarating for me, to know that Aboriginal people were reading what I was writing, but also believing it, being in tune with it. So And the response from the launch of Dark Emu has been similar. You know, the emails I'm getting from my own people are incredibly encouraging, and you know, I depend on that. That's why I write. You know, why it's not the easiest thing in the world to write books. I'm not whinging, but because I have a fantastic life, I've always been lucky, and I continue to be lucky. But it is a hard job, and when your own people ring up and say thanks for that, brother, I'm really moved. It means a lot to me.
Bruce, before you were talking about when this book was finished, it was actually finished before Bill Gammage's book, The Biggest Estate on Earth, was completed, but his came out before yours. And, of course, his touches on the very topic that we're talking to you about with Dark Emu, in that that Aboriginal people weren't hunter-gatherers, and that there were sophisticated land management systems in place that included farming.
Yeah, well, Bill was doing all that work on fire and the use of fire and how the country was deliberately managed by Aboriginal people. And this book just takes that further in talking about the seeds that were sown and how the land was cultivated and irrigated and they harvested. When I was researching the idea about Aboriginal agriculture, because I live in the bush, I don't have access to libraries as much as other people. I don't belong to a university or anything like that. I'm just working on my own. So I did what everyone does. I Googled Aboriginal agriculture. The first 34 or 35 things that came up were about South Australian grain harvests and, you know, the stump jump plough and stuff like that. And then I came to Bill Gammage's name when he was talking about the issues that he raised in The Biggest Estate on Earth. But the one next to that was a fellow called Rupert Gerritsen, who wrote Australia and the Origins of Agriculture. Now, he couldn't get his book published in Australia. He had to get it published in London. And it is the meanest production of a book you can possibly imagine. You know, it's a one-colour cover. You know, its production is pretty ordinary, to tell you the truth, but inside it's all gold. And we owe an incredible debt to Rupert Gerritsen. He's not an Aboriginal fella, but he left teaching at a university because they couldn't stomach his ideas. So he had to go out on his own and become a private researcher. And you imagine, you know, what that cost him financially and security-wise. But he did it because he believed in it. And I'm forever in debt to that fella.
What was so unpalatable? What was he writing?
Well, he was talking about the fact that he didn't think Aboriginal people were hunters and gatherers.
Okay, right.
He was talking about agriculture. He was talking about the fact that in the Hutt River in Western Australia, when Lieutenant Grey first arrived there, the first European to see that country, then he, pardon my dogs, one's called Yambala, one's called Wongrabel, good blackfella dogs, but a bit noisy. When Grey came across those areas at Hutt River, he was looked across a land that reached to the horizon that had been turned over by Aboriginal hoes. And he was amazed that so much land could be tilled and harvested by Aboriginal people. And he then went around that ground because you couldn't cross it. It had been so deeply tilled that you couldn't walk across it. He came to a little hill. He looked out from that hill and to the horizon again, saw tilled land. This is absolutely massive agriculture. Gerritsen also told the story about Sir Thomas Mitchell standing on a hill in Western Victoria and looking across a plain that stretched to the nearby mountains, and it was absolutely yellow with flowers, and those flowers were the yam daisy. This was deliberately cultivated land, and those yams were in the place where originally a forest must have been. This is the richest soil in Australia and didn't have a tree on it. Aboriginal people had removed the trees and planted yam. This is a massive agricultural undertaking. So when I read Rupert's book, I thought, well, it's amazing that Australia is so reluctant to accept this idea of Aboriginal achievement. And I felt that if no one else was going to do it, as Kevin Gilbert said, I would have to do it. So that's how I got involved in it. But
did you find
a lot of Aboriginal people, a lot of non-Aboriginal people helped me.
Mm. So you found other descriptions by early explorers of describing farming practices then, apart from those two examples you mentioned from Rupert's research?
Yeah, I read in Charles Sturt's journal, the great Australian explorer, you know, the favourite of all Australian school students. Sturt was dying. The temperatures were so hot in the desert that he was so-called exploring that the lead was falling out of pencils. He had scurvy. His offside of pool had died a couple of weeks earlier from scurvy. The horses were so weak they could only walk in a straight line. They got to the top of a sand dune and began stumbling down, and they were hailed by 400 Aboriginal people. Sturt said, "We were so weak that we couldn't have turned back if we'd wanted to. We stumbled to the bottom of the hill. The horses couldn't turn around. If those people had had any ill will towards us, they could have killed us in an instant. But instead, the Aboriginal people brought up well water from a well they dug 30 foot deep, gave it to the men, and then turned around with a coulomb of water for the horses, an animal which they had never seen, and allowed those horses to drink from the coulomb. They then brought roast duck for the men to eat and cake that they'd made from flour that they'd harvested from the grain that they had sown in the bed of the Warburton River and harvested. Not only had they made flour from that grain, they'd stored the flour. So although they weren't living on the bank of that river for a full 12 months of the year, they were there for a substantial part of the year and had a village there to prove it. One of the most serene places, Sturt says, that he'd ever been in. And every night around 5 or 6 o'clock, women would be grinding seed on the grindstones, and he said the sound, that swishing sound of the grindstone working to produce the flour for that night's meal, said, was absolutely magical. People were singing, kids were laughing, and then at 10 o'clock, the whole camp was absolutely silent. He said it was like a magical experience.
And were you able to find evidence like this across the whole of the country?
Everywhere. That's the extraordinary thing about it. It's not just Lake Conder in Victoria and Brewarrina in New South Wales. It's across the country. High Cliffy Island in Western Australia, as remote as you can get, had really substantial houses built because people were working in aquaculture there. On the Murray River in Victoria, the Murray and all the rivers that ran into it had been dammed in places so as to create aquaculture systems. One of the first Europeans to visit the area saw an Aboriginal man fishing off one of these earthen walls that had been built across the river, and he had a machine that was snaring fish at the bottom of the river, flinging them back onto the bank, and he was just throwing them into a basket. It was a fishing machine. And yet the man who saw it said, instead of extolling the virtues of the engineering involved, said, I'd always heard that Aboriginal people were very lazy, but this proved to me that that was the truth. His presumption that Aboriginal people were hopeless had skewed his whole intelligence to believe that this was an example of the Aboriginal indolence and laziness, when in fact it was an indication of Aboriginal labour invention and intelligence.
Of course, there's this entrenched view that our mob have been hunters and gatherers, and that view has existed for centuries. And one book isn't going to overturn it at all, unfortunately, is it, Bill, Bruce? That's the reality here, unless
that's
people
right.
start accepting from writers like yourself and others that have come before you.
Well, it's one book's not going to do it, but our own people, you know, often accept the label that's been put on them of hunters and gatherers. I hear Aboriginal people say it all the time. It's time for us to resist that. Not to, you know, try and pump ourselves up, but to acknowledge the achievement of our ancestors, because our ancestors managed this country across the whole continent and the islands, and they did so without ever going to war. That's never been done in the world before. We have to... this is like a diamond the size of a Toyota Ute that the world really has to treasure. This is one of the greatest acts of diplomacy the world has ever seen, the greatest act. And I want our young people to learn this. One book is not going to change that. But our own young people need to be proud, need to get themselves tooled up so they can resist the deprecation that non-Aboriginal people make about our culture and us. You know, it's not good enough for us to say, like I've heard some Aboriginal people say, oh, you know, it's traditional for us to drink and smoke and gamble and not go to work. What absolute rubbish. Our people built earthen walls across huge rivers. The labour involved in that was enormous. Our people were workers. They might have had more leisure time than Europeans, but that's because we had more culture to maintain. We need our young people to be proud, not to fall for this absolute rubbish of Aboriginal people as being hopeless. I want, you know, if half a dozen young Aboriginal people read the book and think, I'm going to do something with my life, then I'd be incredibly happy. But look, it's underway. It's not this book or Bill Gammage's book or anyone else's book. This is underway. I see so many young, strong Aboriginal people determined to do the right thing by their culture. And there are more and more and more of them. I've been mentoring young Aboriginal writers for about 25 years. In the early days, it was hard to find an Aboriginal writer. They might have been there, but they weren't coming forward. Now we're being overrun by simply remarkable writers. You know, I'm thinking of Marie Munkara, you know, came out of the blue and wrote a fantastic book about missions up north. And, you know, I'd never heard of her. So, and now she's writing all the time and is a simply fantastic writer. And there's, you know, these people are coming out of the blue. Jared Thomas from South Australia, Anita Heiss from New South Wales. Look, nothing can stop Aboriginal people. The ball's rolling, and just watch out. Don't get in its way.
Dark Emu. Where did you come up with the name?
Well, I first thought of it when my son showed me the etching
place.
Of the emu on the stone in New South Wales near the Blue Mountains. But soon after that, I learnt... Actually, I didn't know this, so it was all new to me, that the dark emu was in the sky in the Milky Way, a space between the stars, and... you know, the creator spirit, Byami, the emu, was there looking over everything that Aboriginal people were doing and the creation. So I thought then that I would like to call it Dark Emu, and I went to a number of Aboriginal elders and asked if they thought it would be an insult for me to talk about Aboriginal spirituality in that way, and they all thoroughly approved of the idea. So that's where the title came from.
I was thinking it was more related to that Western idiom about, you know, the elephant in the room. I mean, here's all this evidence in there that was written by the by the explorers and the farming that was happening on this country by Aboriginal people, and that, you know, was just largely being ignored. But that was just me thinking at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, as you just explained, it's got nothing to do with that.
Well, it's not a bad way of describing it. I think that, you know, we Aboriginal people are still resisting. We lost the war, but we now can win the treaty or whatever comes next. I'm in no position of authority to talk up treaty or native title or whatever. We've got excellent administrators and philosophers who can do that for us, but something has to happen in Australia. We have to have a new dialogue between black and white. You know, white Australians aren't going to go anywhere. They're going to stay here, obviously. So we have to have that dialogue. But it has to be an equal dialogue, and it has to be based on the truth of our existence. We don't want people trying to reconcile with us as the poor old hunter-gatherer, you know, the blighted Aborigine. We want to be reconciled as a people with the most successful economy and successful government the world has ever known. And I'm fascinated by how the old people were able to get everybody to agree that this would be the thing to do, even on the micro level of getting people to agree to burn a particular area, to sow a particular seed, to till it in a particular way, to build a dam, something I'd never heard about until I started working on this book, to build a dam so it could be irrigated. To get everybody to work together meant that all the young people must have been in total belief that their ancestors were right. And that has never happened anywhere in the world. Always some system has blown up into a war where the powerful win and take control, then there's another war, etc., etc. This never happened in Australia. So our system of government, our system of culture, our system of religion is incredibly powerful and requires the world's attention, not just Australia, because, you know, such a system of government and religion would be terribly useful in Lebanon today, in Israel today, in all the trouble spots around the world. And I think it'd be useful in Australia today.
You were saying that so far the response, particularly from First Nations people, have been largely positive. I did see, in terms of the media reviews, got a positive review in The Age, but I'm just sort of, you know, I don't know whether you're bracing yourself for, you know, the Keith Windschuttles of the world to have a go at what your, you know, the evidence that you've, you know, gathered to support your case that, you know, there was agriculture and it wasn't by accident.
Well, you know, I am braced. I said in Brisbane 30 years ago that every time an Aboriginal person wakes up, it's a political act. So every time you wake up, you're prepared to have to defend your culture. And you do it daily, sometimes several times a day. You are having to defend the culture, defend your people, defend your own rights to call yourself an Aboriginal person, in my case, because I'm so pale. All of these things, it's just constant. And so, I'm ready for people to disagree, but they can't deny the facts. They can't say this doesn't appear on page 242 of Sturt's journal. They can't say that on, you know, page 138 of Mitchell's journal that he passed through a village of 1,000 people, and the next day he passed through a similar one, and the next day a similar one. They can't say that Gray didn't see these massive fields of agriculture. They can't say that because that's what the explorers said. And as I said before, everyone loves a good explorer. And it's down there in black and white. They can argue, well, this is not fully blown agriculture, but I'm not interested in that. It's not fully blown hunter-gathering either. But, you know, putting a label on it is the least important thing of all. Recognising that it happened that Aboriginal people had managed this land and managed the government of the whole country through the Songlines, I'm presuming, that this is a massive achievement. And so really, you know, they'll be struggling to lay a glove on me because the research, I think, is pretty good. You know, the bibliography is extensive. I've read a lot. I don't think they can argue it didn't happen. All they can argue is that it doesn't mean this or it doesn't mean that. But that's just all semantics as far as I'm concerned. I'm interested in our country having a better mutual understanding of each other. Like I said before, you know, black people aren't going away, white people aren't going to go away. What are we going to do about it? We could, you know, live in total denial, like the country seems to be doing at the moment, or we can embrace each other. And I hope when we do, that Aboriginal people will be given credit for the management of the country, and that there'll be intellectual property recognised in some of these grains and some of the plants, because someone's going to make a lot of money out of them. And I hope it's Aboriginal people who do that.
What are the plants that you've identified in the book that you know that obviously have are still around today?
Well, recently, Yuin people found a whole pasture of yam daisy, Microceros lanceolata. In fact, there were three or four varieties of them in a paddock that had never had superphosphate on it and never had sheep on it. Just one of those accidents of history. But superphosphate will kill it stone dead, and sheep will eat it out overnight. So this is just an accidental plot that has been left intact, and it's full of yam daisy. This is a plant there's Aboriginal people in East Gippsland growing this plant now. About half a dozen of us are cultivating yam daisy so that we can get some scientific data together on how it grows, what it needs, and what the yields are. So that's one plant that I think, you know, has real commercial possibilities. It's like a small potato, like one of those little Kifla potatoes. I think that's the name of them, little tiny one.
Yep.
But they've got 10 times the nutrients of a normal potato, and they don't require as much water. They grow naturally in Australian soils. They're largely pest-free. That's a commercial plant. And why aren't we using it? Because we can't embrace the idea that Aboriginal people had some agency in the land, that Aboriginal people were managing the land. There are grains like Mitchell's grass, called after Mitchell, of course, wasn't called after the people who'd been growing it for 40,000 years. But there were all sorts of grains that were grown. Something like 70 or 80 different grains were grown, and many of them are gluten-free. And rice. Just recently, Australian horticulturists have been examining what they call native rice in Queensland, and its harvest is quite phenomenal. Mm. It's not as great as the cultivated rice in Asia, but it's a very abundant harvest that they're getting off this plant, and it was managed by Aboriginal people.
Is it like a quinoa or something like that, is it?
Beg your pardon?
Is it like that quinoa, that ancient grain? Or
Yeah. It's a true rice. Mm. In fact, the university in Queensland, Southern Cross, I think, is looking at cultivating it simply because the rices as grown in Asia are beginning to have genetic flaws because of the monoculture that they've experienced. So they're looking at the Australian rice as one of the parent rices. You know, and once again, I just hope that Aboriginal people are going to be acknowledged when someone makes $1 million out of growing Australian rice.
Well, if we look at bush tucker already that's in our restaurants and in our supermarkets, finger limes, comes to mind. I've just only noticed that at our local Coles. There's also the Warragul greens and bush tomatoes and that sort of thing. So are these the kind of plants that are, that the Aboriginal people were growing before the colonialists arrived?
Yeah, all of those plants were favourites of Aboriginal people. Bush tomato was deliberately planted around the camps, and sometimes, just like an ordinary tomato, it sprang up of its own accord because people were consuming it, and it grew in our manure. But a lot of it was grown by people carrying seeds from one camp to another to spread bush tomato. Kwandong was a real favourite, and Kwandong seeds were carried around to new places so that they could be there for the harvest. The palms in Palm Valley in Northern Territory, some said they were a relic of the Ice Age, ages past when the centre of Australia was tropical. But in fact, it's now believed by scientists, and you've got to believe them, that they were planted by Aboriginal people as a food source. There's a lot to be learnt, and not just about those culinary items like, lemon...
the finger limes.
The finger lime you mentioned before, and bush tomato, bush raisin, bush banana, all of those things, because they're kind of groovy. They're sort of restaurant foods. And, while it was... big, and they fitted in with the idea of hunting and gathering, just picking a few bush tomato here, just, picking up some raisin there. But what I was interested in was that there was deliberate agriculture going on, and no one seems to want to talk about the grains and the tubers that Aboriginal people were managing over all those years.
And you were talking about the yam daisy there and describing it, with the yellow flowers. I'm sure it makes an appearance in Kate Glenville's Secret River book. And I was just wondering whether she was reading Rupert's book.
Yeah, well, Kate is a very serious about her work. I know Kate. I've actually had some criticisms of Secret River, mainly because the Aboriginal people in it hardly ever speak. It in many ways it felt to me just like all the other novels written by non-Aboriginal people, where we were sort of background. We were the flora and fauna in the background. That's a bit unfair to Kate Grenville because she's a serious writer and a serious person. But I was annoyed that Aboriginal people weren't allowed to speak in that novel. But she does mention that, that there were forms of Aboriginal activity managing the land. So in some ways that's one of those little steps forward that Australia has to take. But we, as Aboriginal people, I don't think we can just accept what is thrown up to us by the universities or by the writers or by, the academics. We have to go back to our ancestors, what our grandmothers and grandfathers told us, what their grandmothers and grandfathers told them, and think about all of these things through that prism. Look at it through Aboriginal eyes. Don't just accept that these highly qualified academics know. And if we have a different opinion, we're going to have to back it up. We can back it up through our own people, but we can also back it up by going back through the white history, through the explorers' diaries, through those old photographs. There's a magnificent photograph I use in Dark Emu of a young Aboriginal man coming out of a river with two huge fish at Brewarrina. And when I was trying to put a caption to the photo, no one knew what the fish was because it's disappeared. The Aboriginal management of that river had allowed that fish to survive, and as soon as the dams were put right across the river there, the fish died because its breeding ground was upstream. So that photograph was really significant. It told an incredible story about what had happened in Australia. And, you know, I was in Brewarrina when I first saw that, and I said to some young Aboriginal kids mucking around in the park, they should have been at school, but they were playing with their dog in the park there. And I said, you know, do you know what was down in your river? Do you know that your river and the stone structures there, one of the most significant places in the world? And they had no idea. And I thought that was the saddest thing I'd heard for a decade. And I want those two girls who were 11 and 12, probably 17, 18 now, I hope you're still at school, kids. I really hope that you've taken up the spear from your grandmothers and your grandfathers and challenging what has been said about your people.
And you give that story about the fish there. One has to wonder then, you know, by that same token, what plants or medicines and that sort of thing might have been trampled by the hooves of sheep and cattle and disappeared forever.
It makes me wonder about that all the time, Karen, because I, you know, when I learnt that the sheep demolished the yam daisies in Victoria overnight, like you, I thought, what else disappeared at the same time? You know, in the town where I live down here in Victoria, there's an Aboriginal well, and everyone assumes it was, you know, dug by European sailors when they were engaged in the whaling industry down here. It's an Aboriginal well. I mean, there's no doubt about it, because the first people who walked through here took water from it. It existed here before Europeans arrived. So to demean it by saying that it was built by, you know, the ship's captain so he can get water into his barrels, you know, that's just one of those lies of history which are designed to demean Aboriginal people.
Lies and assumptions.
All this evidence is just piling up, and it's going to be ignored unless our people do something about it.
What's next on the card for you, Bruce?
I'm going down the lake this afternoon, and I'm going to get some mussels, and I'm going to enjoy eating them. And I'm going to take my dogs with me, so I'll stop barking for a while. But I've got a couple of novels that I'm working on.
Mm.
And the first one talks about, you know, the impulse in the human being to go to war and be cruel to each other. And the second book in that series looks at the Australian experience and why it didn't happen. I've enjoyed writing those books, and they're very powerful in my heart. I don't know how enthusiastic the publishers will be, but, you know, I'm always hoping. And I'm also writing on a couple of film scripts for Blackfella Films and people like that, who I love working with, you know.
That's Rachel Perkins' production, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Darren Dale, all that mob, you know, they're wonderful. I'm watching the Red Fern now again as DVDs, and just thinking, you know, what a sort of benchmark in Aboriginal history that show was, how it's changed things, and now SBS are broadcasting that other new show coming up this coming Saturday. His name I've just forgotten, but you know, these things couldn't have happened 10 years ago. They wouldn't have happened 10 years ago, but now they are. So we have to get on board and really, you know, help out those heroes like old Uncle Charlie and his kids, and make sure that they're not left, you know, pushing the barrow on their own.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the time you spent with us, Bruce. You and your dogs. Go take them for a walk, and we will catch up with you hopefully in the near future talking about some of your new works as well.
Good on you, Karen.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Good on the mob up there.
No worries. Bruce Pascoe, the author of Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident.